History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right there in your neighborhood that should not go untold. We found out about the veteran we're going to meet today from one of his neighbors in Grover Beach, California. Paul James got to accompany 89-year-old Tom Davis on an honor flight to Washington, D.C., and he heard a pretty remarkable story of survival from this Purple Heart recipient. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you know we hear almost exclusively from veterans of World War II on this program. Some of them, of course, also served in the Korean War and some even in Vietnam. But I'm often asked when and if I'll move on to veterans of the Korean War, whose stories can be just as intense and meaningful, of course. And my answer generally is that I'll keep talking to World War II vets as long as they're around to tell their stories. The reality, of course, is that veterans of the Korean War aren't much younger than those who served in World War II. And that conflict itself has been so overlooked that it's even been dubbed the Forgotten War. Well, we're going to hear about how one man from the 1st Cavalry Division experienced the Korean War today. But as always, I'd like to start a little earlier on in the chronology. And just like World War II vets, just about every Korean War veteran has a memory of December 7th, 1941. So, Tom, what's yours? I guess you were all of 12 years old.
The day the Japanese attacked it. We are hunting wild pigeons in Cuella Meca in Southern California. And my grandfather and I were walking back from hunting, and the news came over that Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese, and we said we got to get out of here right now because he was vice president of the Southern California Edison Company, and we had to get back right now. So in Balboa at that time, we had a little boat that we could go to Catalina Inn back and forth that my grandfather owned and my dad built. But anyway, he gave that to the Navy to right away so they could have it for guarding our coast. And so that was one of the things he did for them. So that was kind of interesting.
I bet you had some adventures on that boat.
Oh, yes. I had went to Catalina and quite a bit and everything else, fished and everything off of that thing. But the most interesting thing I had, hard to understand how something can come up in your childhood and not know anything about it other than what took place right at that point in time. And that Pearl Harbor took place, and Christmas is not too far away from that. So we always spent Christmas with my grandfather. Well, I was there at my grandfather's house for Christmas dinner and everything else, and the doorbell rang. And there was a guy that a taxi had brought him there, and he said to my grandfather, "Can you pay the taxi driver?" And he was the captain of one of the boats that were turned over in Pearl Harbor. And he was in an insane asylum here. They put him in there because they didn't want him to tell anything. And he was telling my grandfather, and I'm 12 years old, listening to this story, and he said that Roosevelt knew that the Japanese were coming. And he was mad because he said they could have got us all out of there without any problem at all and got us out in the open waters, and we wouldn't have been all killed like they got killed there. He was furious. And then it wasn't more than 10 minutes went by, it seems like, and the Army showed up and said, "He's crazy. We got to get him back to the crazy house." And I can remember that, and it all took place when I was just a young kid. Now, I never forgot that.
So this guy was a friend of your grandfather's or something?
Yes, he was. And I don't know what his relationship was with my grandfather, but he knew that my grandfather was an important person, and he wanted to tell him what was going on, you know, and I don't understand it, but I can remember that with my childhood. I look at the things that happened, and I end up going into the service, and I go through basic training, and they give you a rifle. This rifle has to be taken care of and everything else. And as soon as I'm out of basic training, they take it away from you. And I go up to Sacramento and wait for the trip to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. And They gave me a new rifle, brand new rifle. It cost me, and I had to clean the whole thing. As soon as I got on the ship, they took it away from me again. I get to Japan, and they give me a brand new one again, and I had to clean it all up and everything else and go out and target practice and shoot it in. And when I got to Korea, they took it away from me again. I never saw the same rifle ever again until I got to... I ended up with a BAR, an automatic, where I fold in when I got in combat.
Well, and I want to hear about combat, but there was another palpable way that December 7th changed your life. You had been living in Venice in Southern California, right on the coastline?
In Venice, where Playa del Rey, I was living on the coast there, up on the hillside there, and what happened was the Army came in with a big cannon and put it on the hillside, thinking that the Japanese would try to hit the shorelines, and so they'd have this cannon sit at the end of the block from my street. And my mother says, no, I think we better get out of here because I don't think this is safe for us. So otherwise, I'd have still probably be in Los Angeles area. But we moved into L.A. area and further in town so we'd be safer. But the Japanese never did hit the shoreline there. But I went to Venice School in Venice there called Nightingale Grammar School. I became a junior lifeguard. And we were on the, we got my brother and I are both, well, there was quite a few of us that were junior lifeguards, but out of the school. We had to swim out a mile and back in a mile. And I went out the first time and came back and made the first pass out and back and made it the first time. That was part of the training, and I did it the first time. My brother didn't make it, and he had to make another pass at it. It's pretty tough to go swimming out a mile and then back in again.
And I know we're going to talk about the Korean War, but I have a few more questions about that World War II period. Other than having to move inland because what was happening was spooking your mother a little bit, did you notice life changing around Southern California after Pearl Harbor?
Oh, yes. After Pearl Harbor, it changed quite a bit. The shorelines, everything was all guarded by military. And so it was sort of a military area there completely. The reason we're Playa del Rey is and Manhattan Beach, in between the two areas, there's a shipping lane that came in there and brought oil in, so that was quite a worry too for us, because you'd think the Japanese would try to sink those oil tankers coming in. They were worried about it all. That whole coastline there was guarded quite heavily with the army and everything. The main airport down there, that's where they made all the P-38s and everything else. They flew right over by our house, and we could see them flying out. And that was the first time I ever saw a flying wing that they had. They had one fly out, and I saw it fly up over the house, and it was quite high. But it was kind of interesting to see all the military stuff going out. So my family was really worried about, my mother was really worried, and we better get out of here, but this is not a safe place to be. So that's why we moved into L.A. I didn't like moving in because I used to love the water and everything else down there.
What about, had you had in school any Japanese-American friends before that?
I had Japanese friends, but they were my grandfather's and my grandmother's. She had a Japanese maid and a Japanese gardener, and the Famiku is their name, and they had to take them away and put them in the concentration camp at that time. And so I missed them then because they were good friends of ours. You know, I mean, I didn't know any Japanese people until later on. The Japanese, when I was over there, they were really wonderful when I was in the hospital there. I didn't have a problem with them there. They were nice. They took care of me really, really well.
And we're going to hear what put you in the hospital, but wrapping up those earlier years, so you experienced all of World War II as a kid and then a teenager in Southern California. Do you remember what it was like when all of those civilians in L.A. found out, hey, the war is over, the Allies have won, and what had been a good chunk of your life to that point, you didn't have to worry about anymore?
Well, we didn't think we'd have to worry about it anymore because it was all over with. That was quite a celebration they had, you know, and then everybody came back home, and the ones that were still alive came back home anyway. But I had no idea that we were going to get ourselves into another one right away, but it one ends and we were right back into a Korea. It was President Truman got us into that one, and MacArthur there. I was disappointed that he took MacArthur out of that, because he had it won. He was doing a good job until then, and then all of a sudden we ended up with a halfway done job and never did finish the job right.
Well, and that part of the world has been in the headlines here recently too, with President Trump. And as I understand it, when the Korean War started, you didn't think that you were going to be a part of this. You didn't think the Army was going to want you or would take you if you wanted to go?
I didn't know that they even was going to do anything about it, you know. It started, and it looked like it went, and then it signed a peace treaty. Actually, they didn't sign it. North Korea never signed the peace treaty until later on. I guess they signed it once or twice or something of that case. They really never honored it anyway. But the thing is, I never thought I'd have to go, but situation came about where they were drafting everybody, and so everybody was, and all my friends were joining the National Guard, so they thought that way they'd stay here and not end up, because they were supposed to be in California, and stay here in California, and they'd be safer that way, and they all ended up over there anyway. Uh-huh. So I ended up before they got there. I was there before they got there.
But you want to tell me why you didn't think they would take you?
I was involved in racing and everything else, and racing boats, and a friend of mine had a boat, and I got to play with it quite a bit, and down at Marine Stadium, and it's a hydroplane, and it was a four-cylinder Ferguson engine in the darn thing with all welded up and differently. It had four ports in it and everything else. Anyway, to make a long story short, it had a fire extinguisher. You break the handle off of it, and it would squirt carbon tetrachloride. Well, I broke it off by accident, and it went off in my face and got me in my eyes and everything else. And I tried to wash everything out, and I ended up with carbon tetrachloride poisoning, which they thought it was jaundice. And so they said that my doctor said they'd never take you in the Army because you got jaundice. And so when I went down to the Army, the doctors were all standing there taking all these guys in. And this doctor, I handed him the paper, and it's, he looked at it, and he says, "You look fine. You're in the Army." That quick. So I didn't have any choice. I didn't even have a chance to go back home even. That was it. And I was changed clothes, and that was it.
But that's after all your buddies have signed up for the National Guard, which you probably would have done if you hadn't believed they wouldn't take you.
Yeah.
Then they end up drafting you after all. What'd they do with you? Tell me what the training was like and what kind of outfit they put you in.
They put me in the on a bus and shipped me to San Luis Obispo area. Well, actually, it's up there by about 50 miles north of Paso, and I was out in the desert. And as far as I was concerned, I had no idea where in the hell I was. But anyway, the Army was there. They had the training, and we went through training. And it was, first of all, we had to go take a test, and that was about a two-hour test. And that was kind of crazy. And you have this two-hour test and everything else, paperwork all over the place, and they take you away from there and go on into the training. And I never knew what the hell the test was all about and why they even had the test, you know. They didn't say anything, you know, until... It was kind of crazy, you know. You got went through basic training and everything else, and all of a sudden they bring you out, and after you finish your basic training, target practicing and everything, and they brought us out and at attention, and we're all standing there at attention. They start calling people's names out, and they called my name out, and they said half of them were called out, and the other half didn't get called out. And then they said, "You're entitled to go to officer candidate school. You graduated when you took that test. You got 80% on it, so... you can go to officer candidate school." And I said, "Well, that sounds like a nice idea." So they said, "But you're going to have to give up the 2 years you're going in for. You're going to go in for 4 years." And I said, "No, I don't think I want to stay here. 2 years is long enough." So I refused the opportunity to go into officer candidate school. And that was a mistake, maybe, because they sent me immediately overseas.
Whereas, had you accepted officer candidate school, maybe by the time you finished all that, the Korean War would have been over?
Yes, the war would have been over by the time. Anyway, I wouldn't have probably gone over there as an officer anyway, but if I imagine 4 years in there. If you're going to go in for four, you might as well stay in the rest of the time, because 4 years of being an becoming an officer is wasted time. You might as well stay in the rest of the time, because the Army isn't that bad. So I would say that would be a good way to stay in the Army. I didn't think it was more like jail at first, and so I didn't want to be involved in it.
And that decision that you made almost cost you your life.
That's correct. It did. I got over to Japan, and from Japan, I went to Korea, and then Korea, they sent me over to the front, right to the front lines.
And we're going
to
hear what he experienced on those front lines when we come back. Tom Davis, 89 years old, of Grover Beach, California, is our guest today. Find photos and a short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Tom Davis of Grover Beach, California. 40 years ago, you might have caught him flying through Marine Stadium in Long Beach in Shoot the Rapids, his blown fuel hydro racing boat. But nearly 70 years ago now, he was with the 1st Cavalry Division fighting in the Korean War. When we left off, Tom was explaining how he was sent right to the front lines as soon as he arrived overseas.
I went straight to the front lines, and I got there by... Craziest things happen to you. It's a long ways to drive from Seoul to where the front lines was. And we were riding on the stateside truck, in the back of that truck. And it came to an intersection, and they had to stop. And I couldn't figure out, when we're on a convoy, why we had to stop. Well, there was a guy going across the street in front of us carrying a telephone pole on his back. And he's bent halfway over, and he had to stop for him because we had no choice. But he's carrying this thing on his back, and I could not believe a human being could carry a telephone pole on his back like that. But anyway, we went all the way up to the front lines, and then when I got there, it was dark, and everybody came back off a firefight, and they brought us over there, and they said, okay, there was a guy, a pretty good-sized guy next to me, that was brought up in the truck, and he was about 6 foot tall, I think he was. And anyway, they handed him the BAR, and he said, I don't want that damn thing. And he said, well, you're going to have some kind of a weapon up here. And he said, well, I don't want the BAR. And I said, give the BAR to me. And he said, no, you're too small. And I said, no, you don't worry about me and the gun. I said, just give me the BAR. I want the BAR. And he said, turn to the other guy that was taller than I was, and he said, you'll carry his ammunition then. So he had to end up hoping that I'd be able to shoot the thing and protect his life, because all he had was a pistol.
And am I correct in assuming that the reason he didn't want the BAR is because he figured it would make him a target?
Well, you only have 5 minutes in time in combat to live with a BAR, any automatic weapon. They're the first ones you're going to kill. And so you're the target, and that's all there is to it. So if you take that, And I figured I had plenty of use of a gun when I was hunting all the time, and so I knew how to use a gun, and I figured I could handle that gun with no problem at all. So he didn't want it because he knew he only had, in basic training, they told you only had 5 minutes in combat. And automatic weapons, that's the first person you're going to try to knock out. It's pretty tough.
But you heard that, too, in basic training. So what made you say, yeah, I want that. I want that target on my back.
Well, I didn't care whether it was a target on my back. I wanted the most ammunition I could have because I was a good shot. I shot birds, and I shot deer and everything, and I could use it. And I didn't realize it at the time until we got into combat what it meant to be a person that would do what I had to do. The rest of the people knew it, and they'd say, Tom, there's one over here. And I thought, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, why don't you shoot him? But they didn't, because they couldn't shoot a human being. And that was the toughest part about the Army. Not too many people will kill, but they relied on somebody that would. And the only reason I did, because I thought they were animals. And I had no intentions of killing a human being. I just was shooting animals, because I'd shot them before. And so that, to me, it was just, they're animals, and so I had no problem shooting them. It was tough. I didn't realize it at first, but I did afterwards, because when I wounded one guy, he was laying on the ground. That was one evening that I'll never forget, because the lieutenant and I called for flares to be dropped from an airplane so we could see the enemy, and the lieutenant says, we haven't got any information yet that he's the enemy's here. And my first sergeant, he said, he's not going to send the airplane up with flares. And I said, tell him to go to hell. And he said, you tell him to go to hell. And he said, I said, no, you're running his interference. You're my boss. And so anyway, they did finally send the planes up. And the next morning, one of the guys that I shot was still alive. So I said, I grabbed the lieutenant and I said, I want to show you what a dead one looks like. I thought he was still dead. I said, well, hell, he's still alive. And I said, he's trying to throw a hand grenade at you. And he said, shoot him. And I said, no, he's not going to hurt anybody. I said, he can't even have him raise his arm hardly. I said, he's down for the count now. I said, if we don't take care of him, we'll shoot him. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. You do it if you want to shoot him. Or I refused to shoot the guy. That's the first time I realized he was a human being. As far as I was concerned, they were all animals at first, and I didn't have any problem shooting them, you know. But when I saw he was a human being that I'd shot, and he was still alive, I wasn't going to shoot him again.
So then you took him prisoner, or what?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what ever happened to him, you know. I hope that they did, you know, because we moved on from that position to where I ended up being in another firefight. So I don't know what happened to him, you know. When I left that position, we'd go on patrols looking for the enemy constantly. We'd be maybe in your bunker for 2 or 3 days, and then we'd go out for a day and a half out in the woods looking for the enemy. And if we didn't find him, we came back, you know. But somebody else would be taking over my bunker while I was gone. It was kind of a rough deal. It was not fun at all.
And how old were you when you got over there?
You know, I was 20. I think I turned 21 when I was over there. Anyway, I know I had a birthday over there. Because it was September the wounded in October, so I had to be go past my birthday. I don't remember celebrating it. Yeah. It was just a day that went by.
And I want to hear about when you got wounded, but I'm also interested, were there some close calls that you had before that that maybe put that thought in your mind, hey, I'm in a pretty dangerous position out here?
One firefight that I was running the BAR, and I kept worrying about running out of ammunition, because if the lieutenant wouldn't send the airplanes up there, wouldn't drop the flares, because he didn't think there was any enemy out there, how was I going to get enough ammunition to stay through the night, you know? And fortunately, I did, but only had what I had on me, and once that ran out, then I was a dead person myself. I mean, if the enemy knows that gun stopped shooting, there's got to be something wrong, you know. He's either out of ammunition or he's dead, one of the two, you know. So I told the guys, I said, as soon as that flare goes out, because there's two of us in the bunker besides myself, and I said, as soon as that flare goes out, I says, we're getting the hell out of here. And he said, what do you mean you're getting out? I said, you don't think they know where we are? I said, I've been telling them where we are for quite some time now, you know, that he's got tracer bullets going out of this gun. Every fifth one has got a tracer bullet, and it's like an arrow pointing right to me. Yeah. I said, so really, they know exactly where I'm at. And so we stay here, we're dead ducks. And so they followed me, and we went back into a different location, and they didn't know where we were then. And so when it came daylight, they left. And as soon as it started, the sun started to come up at all, the enemy leaves. They blew their whistles, and they blow their all their crazy noises, and because they don't all speak the same language, I guess, because they blew whistles and made some contacts and letting everybody know that they need to get out, you know, and they left. I mean, it was just as quiet as a mouse. As soon as they started to leave, it was just quiet. And then the people don't realize what you're fighting in. You're fighting in brush that's 5 feet high or higher, and it's just thousands of brush, and it's only just trails through there. And these guys come out of that brush just like animals coming out. And I just thought they were animals, you know, so I didn't have a problem shooting them because they looked like deer because they're all wearing brown clothes. And at night, they looked like animals as far as I was concerned. So I didn't have a problem shooting them. Most guys didn't understand that problem of me because I wasn't out there trying to kill some innocent person. It was tough. But I didn't think too much about it until I came back and was in the hospital and everything else. Then I thought about it, you know, and I said, "Damn, they don't like to kill people." And I don't think that's a nice thing to be saying I did, you know. But on the other hand, it was either me or them, and so I didn't have a choice.
All right. Well, tell me about October 5th, 1950. How did that day begin, and how did it end for you?
We got up in the morning. They said, "We're going to move out." And I said, "Where are we going?" They said, "Well, we're going to go over here to another location and take over the hill." And I said, "Oh." And so we went out on a long march and start marching, and we got to the top of the hill and started to go down the other side, and we're in single file, and the very last guy in the group, there was probably 200 of us, 200 at least hit the hill originally, but I don't know where the other 100 came from, because it seems to me that it was about 100 in our group, and the last guy on the hill was shot. And he went down. So I said, "We're in enemy territory." We got down to the bottom of the hill. There's a river down there, and it wasn't much of a river. And I don't know whether it was a big river or not at one time. It wasn't much water in it. We could walk across it. I'd say maybe 2 feet deep at the most. And I got out in the middle of it, and I heard an explosion. I looked down to my right, and there was a bomb that went off in the water. It came from them. They shot, it wasn't a mortar. It was very similar to a mortar, does the same thing, except it shows you where it lands. In other words, it was a flare type of thing. It went up in the air, and then went at that end of the, about, I'd say, 200 feet from us, and another one went off above it, and they both hit in the water, in the river. And I said, "Do you see that?" And the guy said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Do you see those two hit?" And he said, "No, I didn't pay any attention to it." And I said, "Well, that just told you they had it zeroed in, because it's got this river zeroed in." I said, "So if we try to come back out of there, they're going to get us." I said, "You got to remember that." And so I forgot about it, you know, because when you get in a firefight, you don't remember a lot of things. But when I did get back, I found out where, well, I almost got to that river when I got hit with a mortar, and it blew me up into a tree, and I had a broken leg and shrapnel in my back and shrapnel in my both arms, and my thigh was almost shot off, and I was laying on the ground, and I was going to heaven.
So as you experienced it, what were you doing when you got hit? What were the moments right before you got hit like?
Well, what happens, we took the hill away from the enemy, as we did, we took over their entire hill there, and we went up to the top of it and got to the, ran them off, and then they had bunkers all around there, and so I climbed into one of the bunkers, and I remembered all the stories when I was in training. Do not pick up any enemy's ammunition, period, because it might be booby-trapped. And so it was full of ammunition on the ground there on where I was in. And I said, "I'm not touching it." So I was in there, and all of a sudden I looked up, and the guy running by me, he says, "Get the hell out of here, Tom." And I said, "Okay, we're going home, go getting out." So I took off, and I was running down the hill, and I must have got hit at that point almost halfway. I was almost down at the bottom when a mortar hit me and blew me up into the tree. And it's actually, when I say a tree, it was probably a good-sized brush, you know, and I was just hung up in that thing. When I came, I was going to heaven, on my way to heaven, and I could see myself going to the pearly gates and everything else, but they didn't open them for me and sent me back. And so I came to, and I said, oh, my God, I'm alive. So I yanked and pulled my leg out and crawled off the hill. And there was 200 of us when we went on that hill, and there was only one person down left. So I'm thinking that when I crawled off the hill, I came around the corner, and the guy said, oh, my God, Tom, we left you for dead. And I said, well, I'm not dead. And he said, and I grabbed a hold of him, and he helped me. And there was one tank. We had was six tanks when we first went into attack. And there were six tanks that were out there shooting overhead fire while we were taking the hill over. And there was only one tank left. And they said they saw us trying to carry me. And they sent five more guys out with a litter, put me on that, and put me on top of the tank and drove me back to a safe zone where they start to take my clothes all off, slowly cut them off, and find out where the wounds are and start to take care of me there. And I told them, I said, don't cut them off. I said, give them to somebody else. It's too damn cold here. I said, I had two pairs of pants on. He said, well, Tom, they're all shot to hell anyway, so I wouldn't worry about where they go. He said, so we're just going to cut them off. But I didn't know that at the time. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't bleeding. And the guy says, you would have bled to death if it had been warmer. And it was so cold that that's the only reason I didn't bleed to death. The blood wasn't circulating. It was so cold. And so I was lucky that way. But it didn't take long that when I was in, they put me in on a truck and took me over to a tent hospital and put me in a tent hospital. And I looked down and I said, I thought, my God, I hope he had a good dinner. Looked like he took the whole thigh out on one side, and it was pretty badly torn up. My back was pretty sore, and I didn't know how bad it was, but it was wounded in the back, too, and both arms and hand. I started seeing little pieces of me. That was stripped nude. They had me stripped nude in the hospital room there, and I could see all these bloody places all over me. It was kind of crazy looking, but I said, give me some more morphine. And they gave me a little bit more, and they said, you've had plenty, so don't worry about it. But anyway, I was a lot of pain by now. It was, the pain started coming on. I didn't have any pain at the beginning of it, but it was so cold, I guess. That's Mother Nature takes care of you when that takes place.
Well, and I have some more questions about that, which we're going to get to when we come back with Tom Davis of Grover Beach, California. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Tom Davis. He'll celebrate his 90th birthday this September in Grover Beach, California, where we recorded this episode out on his front patio. So if you hear the occasional bird or his dog Annie, or perhaps even the Pacific Ocean just a stone's throw away, that is why. If you've ever gone skiing at the China Peak Ski Resort, you've taken advantage of something that Tom built. More on that later, but he wouldn't have had that opportunity if he did not survive a near-death experience near the 38th parallel in Korea nearly 70 years ago. You heard him explain how an enemy mortar shell left him with injuries in his back, chest, arms, and legs. He was left for dead. After coming to, he started crawling, and eventually he was spotted by the last American soldier in the area and helped to safety. One thing I was wondering, as you told that story, Tom, and I'm sure some of the listeners at home were as well, could you feel the impact of that mortar blast, or were you just knocked out immediately?
I was out immediately. I mean, I felt nothing. I felt I was on my way to heaven, and this is the honest to God truth, because I felt that I was on my way, and it was a sort of a long white trail, and just heading up that way, and all of a sudden somebody says, "That can't come in." And so I had to go back. And so I know there's a God, and so I know there's a God, and I know there's something in the next world that I'm going to see when I go. I'm going to see it because I know there's something there that I didn't get to see. And I came back, and the first thing my eyes opened up, I said, "Oh, my God, I'm alive. I thought I was dead all the time. I experienced death." And it was kind of an very interesting. It was peaceful. I didn't have any pain at all. I didn't have any pain until I came to. And I didn't even have any pain until I crawled off the hill and until the guy picked me up and tried to help me get going. Then the pain came because the leg was killing me, and the pain started coming, and I just collapsed. I mean, I couldn't go anymore. I mean, I couldn't help myself. And it was kind of crazy, and I didn't have any pain until then. And I didn't see any blood on me or anything like that, but they said I'd have bled to death, they said, if it was warmer.
So when you come to, I mean, how do you make sense of the reality that you're in? I mean, you don't know if there's enemy out there, if your guys are around. What's that process like when you come to and you're trying to figure out what's going on?
Well, the first thing I did was when I come to, I got to get out of this mess I'm in, you know, and I started crawling down the hill, and I knew I got to get back to that river, as I remembered. And so I was crawling right for that, and I was trying to head for the tanks that I remember seeing when I was in combat, when the fighting started, and tanks were shooting overhead fire. There were six tanks out there, and I knew that they were there, and so I got to crawl that, and that'd be my only way out of here, because I couldn't. There wasn't anybody else around, and I came around the corner there, and here the guy said, "Oh my God, we left you for dead," and I said, "I'm not dead." Yeah. So I put my arm around him, and he tries to. We walk across the creek. River there, and we got it on the other side, and then I collapsed on the other side, and he says, "Get up," and I said, "I can't get up, I can't walk on the leg," and he said, and he couldn't carry me, so I looked up, and I see these guys coming running from the tank, and they have a litter in their hands, and they got over there, and they put me on the litter, and hauled me all the way back to the tank, and then put me on top of the tank, and I don't even remember getting off the tank, or where the tank went when I passed out when I was on top of the tank, I guess. And the next thing I know, I was laying on the ground, and there was about 8 or 10 guys laying there, wounded too, right alongside of me, you know, and they're cutting my clothes off. And I said, "Well, how bad is it?" And he said, "Oh, it's not bad at all." I said, "You mean I got to come back?" And he says, "No, you're not coming back. You got a stateside wound." And I said, "Wow." I couldn't believe that, you know, because a lot of the guys had to come back sometimes to get wounded in the foot or something like that, and then they'd just fix him up and they bring him back out the field again. He'd be out there and get himself shot again. And it's not fun to have to come back to the combat zone and experience it again. Not exciting at all. It's scary. And I don't wish that on anybody.
I don't know if you've ever thought about this. What do you think would have happened to you if that guy wasn't there, if he didn't see you and help you as far as he did?
You asked that question, and I know what I felt, that if I hadn't have been, I'd have crawled as far as I could gone, but I know damn well I would have probably been killed by the enemy. They would have found me, because I couldn't have crawled across the field that far. It was a good quarter of a mile to the tank, and they wouldn't have seen me crawling on the ground, because I was just crawling. When I got to the creek, that's when he was. There was 200 of us there, and then he was the only one left, and there was only one guy left, and he hadn't gone across the creek yet. He saw me coming around the corner there, crawling on the ground, and I was crawling as fast as I could crawl, and I probably would have died probably by the time I got to the tank, because it was another quarter of a mile away, and they wouldn't have seen me crawling across the field in that brush. It was rice paddies. It was what it was. Across there, I had to get through. But no, I thought about it several times. If I hadn't have found somebody there, that I probably would have been killed by the enemy.
Or even if it took you 5 or 10 minutes longer to come to, by that time, all those guys would have been gone.
Yes, he would have been gone. Everybody was gone. There was only one guy left, and he was straggler, and he was ready to cross the creek when he saw me.
Do you remember that guy's name, the guy who found you?
You know, I don't know who he was, and I wished I did. It was hard to recognize anything at that time. It was very difficult. I couldn't see how badly I was wounded because I was sort of still delirious. It was tough.
And you'd been there 3 months by now, so Had you dealt with losing friends of yours, losing guys that you had served with?
Oh, yes. One of the guys was in my basic training. I asked him where he was, and they said he got killed yesterday. And I said, oh, no, my God, somebody's got to call his parents and let them know. It was very disturbing because I went through basic training with him, and he was in combat, and he hadn't been there long enough to even know what the hell the war was all about, you know, and he was killed. It was sad to see somebody get hurt. There's not much you can do, though. I mean, you do the best you can do and try to hang on. I know I made some decisions that I tried to stay alive. That was the main thing I tried to do, but it was tough. It was damn tough. No one knows how tough it is until you're right into that combat. The enemy doesn't care, and he's going after you. So you've got to be on your toes, or otherwise you're going to be killed. I mean, I don't know how anybody makes it through the damn thing.
Well, and you said you're convinced you would have died had that soldier not been there right when you crawled to that point. And I guess the likelihood is your body might still be over there, because there are thousands of American servicemen who their remains have not been brought home yet from that war yet, and people are still working on that. But what I wonder is, when you're in the hospital, when you're starting to take stock of your wounds, was there any fear or concern in your mind that you might not make it, or that your life would be drastically impacted by these injuries?
Once I got wounded, you know, you're in a tent hospital. I was in and out because I was doped up quite a bit, so I didn't have much of a remembrance of that because I was unconscious and out of it. But when they put me on the train and shipped me down to Seoul, there was other soldiers on that train. And I know I was on the bottom bunk, and the guy above me was there, and we were talking to each other. I said, I hope the hell I don't have to come back. And he said, I don't want to come back. That's no fun up here. And so when I got back to Seoul, I go to the hospital. They take us in. They carry me in on a litter, and they open the door. And from the beginning of the hospital door to the far end, as far as I could see, there was bodies on the floor, just hundreds of them. They were waiting to get in to see a doctor, and that's where I was placed. I fall asleep again. The next thing you know, somebody's waking me up into the operating room. That must be midnight or so. And I had, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. It was the oddest thing to have. I had all my clothes taken off, and that was wrapped up in blankets and stuff, but I had my hand, and I had my wallet in my hand. We only made $3 a day when you get $90 a month and something like that. And you get in combat, they give you combat pay, $50 a month combat pay extra. So I had $100 bill in my wallet, and I had my wallet in my hand, and I put it there. And the doctor, I can remember this day, he says, can I have that wallet? And I said, no. And I would not give it to him, you know. And he said, it's okay, that's no problem. And then I wake up after this, the surgery and everything else, and I had a cast on my leg. I felt my chest, my wallet's taped to my chest. I said, oh, what a fool you were. They took it away while I was out, and then they put it back on and taped it to me. It was so funny to find my wallet was taped to my chest with all the shrapnel they took out of me. And he said, the doctor walked by, and he says, boy, I didn't know they used shotguns over there. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you hit everywhere. And I said, well, it doesn't feel good today. It was better. I had a cast on my leg and everything else, but it was kind of strange. And then they package you all up again. On the cast, they mark where your wounds are, because you're not going to stay there in that hospital, because that's all that hospital's for, is to take your patients in and get them out as fast as possible, because they're getting them in by the day, hundreds of them coming in. So they had to get me out and fly me to Japan. I didn't know it at the time, but they mark on the cast there where the wounds are, so the next doctor can look at the cast and say, okay, there's a wound down here, goes through his leg and so forth. But anyway, they fly me to Kobe, Japan, and I go to the hospital there, and the Japanese nurse is there, but they also had an American nurse who was in charge of all the Japanese nurses. But they come in every day, and I had wet soaks on me all the way around. They put and fill with salt water, and they, so the wounds would sort of fill back in again, but my temperature wouldn't go down. And the doctor kept coming in and says, what are you eating? And I said, why? And he said, well, your temperature won't go down. You must be eating something that's not agreeing with you or something, you know. And I said, no, I'm not eating anything I'm not agreeing with it. That was about 3 days, I think maybe 3 or 4 days before they decided they better cut the cast off and see if there's anything there. Well, you can't blame the doctors in combat, you know. They do the best they can with what they got to work with as quick as they can, you know. So when they put a cast on my leg, they marked that where the shrapnel went through my bone, and they marked that circle, but they didn't mark the shrapnel that went into my foot. And so when they cut the cast off, the pus just went everywhere. And they said, oh, my God, he's got another wound somewhere. And so that's why he's having so much trouble. Every day they'd have to take the cast off and drain that wound down there, you know. And the Japanese nurses were sort of dainty. They didn't want to hurt you, and they'd be just as dainty as they possibly could. But it's still painful. And so they'd squeeze it and, you know, and let the – it was terrible. Anyway, maybe 5 days went by, and one day it came by, and I said, oh, man, they forgot me. I get to get by today without – they won't be doing this, because it was painful to have them do that, you know. And about noon, the pain was starting to throb, and the foot was starting to really go to hell. And so I had to pull the buzzer, and the head nurse was an American, and she was in charge of all the Japanese nurses. She says, that's your foot, nobody else's foot. And if you don't tell them to take care of it, nobody else is going to take care of it for you. And she grabbed that damn thing, and everybody in the place said, Tom, don't kick her. You know, I mean, she was just mad as hell at me. She went, bam, she was, what the hell's that? And I said, what do you mean? She said, what popped out? It looks like part of your boot. She pops this part of my boot out of my heel that was in there, and the infection was in there, and then it was just running all over the place. And she said, well, my God, she said, maybe we got it all out of there, you know, and it's going to start to heal. And it did. It started healing from then. I was there 3 months before I could leave that area to come home. And they couldn't let me go unless they got the infection all out, you know. But they didn't know what was causing it until she got mad at me, and she just squeezed so hard, tired. And I mean, I was almost going to kick her. Once that came out, then things started to heal, so then they could package me up and ship me out of there and send me home. And I landed up in Hawaii, and I spent a week in Hawaii, and I told them they'd leave me here. I was happy as hell there. And they said, no, you're going to go to El Paso, Texas. And I said, what do you mean? I don't live in El Paso. And they said, well, that's the nearest hospital that can take care of your problems. I was shipped down to William Beaumont Hospital in Texas. And that is one nice hospital. I mean, they had all the facilities in the world. They had these tubs that you can get into, circulate around to get the circulation going again. I was laying on the bed in there, and I'll never forget this either, because the doctors, they come by. Head doctor would have interns learning the procedure and everything else, and he came along to my bed, and he says, these are things we've got to do for him. And I giving me his pill because that his foot keeps sweating, and we're trying to get something to solve the problem. And I said, I opened my drawer, and I said, there's your pills. And he said, well, what are you doing? And I said, I'm in the swimming pool and over the gymnasium, and I'm doing all the exercises I can possibly do. And he said, nurse, come back here. And she said, I want him to have the run of the hospital. He said, can do anything he wants, or he wants to get well. And he said, five bunks down, he said, that guy doesn't want to get well, and he'll never walk right, ever. He got injured on a motorcycle, and this guy got wounded, he said. From that time on, I had to run to the hospital. I could go swimming pool every day and go in the gym. I got well in 5 months. I spent 5 months down there, and then they sent me back to active duty. I had to be light duty, and so they put me in the post office. So at that time, I didn't like noises at all. They'd have their music on when I come in the post office. They'd have it on pretty loud, and I'd tell them to turn it down, and they did. They didn't want to bother me at all. They said, he has a problem. He doesn't like noises, and I didn't. It was hard for a while.
You point that out, that they recognized in you this desire to recover, to get back to normal, if that's possible. Where did that come from? What prevented you from getting depressed, giving up, thinking your life was never going to be the same? What was it that kept you focused on getting better?
I think that I enjoyed life before I went into service, and so, and I wanted to get back into racing or something. I wanted to get back to my friends again. I really enjoyed life, mainly because I saw where I wasn't really worried about dying ever again, because I knew where I was going when I got wounded, and that outer experience, you might say, seeing a pathway to heaven, I knew I was nothing to worry about. So from that time on, I wanted to enjoy what life I do have left. But that's the way I felt about it. Without that, I don't know if I'd have done as well if I hadn't experienced that out-of-death experience. I have people come by the house here, they're ministers and stuff like that, and say, you don't have to talk to me about God. I know all about him. I don't have a problem with going to see him again or anything. I mean, it's very pleasant. It's kept me going most of my life, knowing the fact that it's not that bad. I know a lot of people. I know this young lady, it's my caretaker. She's been taking care of me. She lost her son in a motorcycle accident, and she just went to pieces. But I said, he's in heaven. He's enjoying life up there. I said, don't worry about him. You'll see him when you go up there. So I really feel that that's the way it is, because what I saw and what I've experienced and over there in combat, it gave me a good different life to look at, you know. So I've been real comfortable with my life ever since. I had a good life at Shaver Lake. My life was there. As a boy, I spent most of my summers up there in the Sierras.
Well, and I'm guessing there are a lot of people listening right now who have benefited from some of your handiwork. Did you really help build the chairlift at China Peak Ski Resort?
Yes, I did. I did most of the welding on it, on the towers. From there on out, I put the shivs all on. When they went bankrupt, and I bought the blower, and then I went into snow business and did a lot of snow removal up there. And,
you know, it's been more than 65 years since you were wounded, and some have called the war you were in, the Korean War, they've called it the Forgotten War. Have there been times in all the years since that you felt that way, that you felt people didn't understand or appreciate what you and all those other Americans did there?
Yes, I did. I don't think that anybody realizes what war is all about anyway. It doesn't matter whether it's a Korean War, Vietnam War, or whatever, you know. World War II was bad enough, but they got celebrating everywhere, New York and everywhere else. But when I went to Honor Flight, that Honor Flight was well worth while going on, because we were honored and for something we never got honored for, because when we came back home, nobody cared. They talked more about Vietnam than they ever talked about Korea, and they didn't honor us at all. So it was kind of nice to go on the honor flight. That was an honor and a half. Everywhere we went, we were honored.
And thanks again to Paul James, Tom's guardian, on that sentimental journey to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Central Coast, California, for suggesting we get to know his neighbor here on Hometown Heroes. I'm so glad we've had that privilege today. Tom Davis, thank you so much for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your one-of-a-kind story. You'll find a few photos of Tom's trip to the Korean War Veterans Memorial and other sites in our nation's capital that you can explore at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.